Welcome to the Wealthy Homes Podcast, where we help young Michigan families manage their finances and create wealth. I'm your host, Connor Bowserman, financial advisor with Preferred Financial Group. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Wealthy Homes Podcast. As you know, I'm always trying to think of different topics and different ways I can bring you guys content and information. And as I was thinking through just financial planning topics, one big one that came to mind, and it's not one that usually comes to mind, especially for our age range, is Social Security. Social Security has been around for a very, very long time, and we continue to think that that's going to be the case. But as we look at retirement planning and retirement income, Social Security in general makes up to a third of most people's retirement income, if not more. So it's really important to know what Social Security is, how it came to be, and kind of the future of what Social Security is, as well as how do you implement it into a retirement plan. So before I kind of get into what it is and how it affects you in retirement income today, I kind of want to take you way, way back to kind of the origins of Social Security and why it was created. So actually, the origins of Social Security started actually before even the Pilgrims came over. And the Pilgrims, when they did come over, they brought what are called the poor laws. And basically what that meant was that they were taking a piece of income or tax in that situation and then giving that to the poor and the needy. So even way, way back then, we knew that we needed to do this for that certain age demographic and for those people in need that just fell on hard times. So all the way back in the 17th century, we started the poor laws or implemented them. But what they found is it was just really, really hard to implement them. Because what happened was is that they had basically money that they were giving to the community. And then they had to turn around and go, okay, who's worthy of these funds? Well, they found that that was just really, really hard to implement. And especially because they didn't have a big, huge government at that time. And they were just trying to figure out how to survive, let alone try to figure out how they can help out the poor and needy. So what they did is they started to create what are called poor houses. And this is kind of what we today use as like homeless shelters and that kind of thing. So what they created were these poor houses where they provided food and shelter. And to make it less desirable, actually, what they did was they sewed the letter P on their clothing. So everybody in public knew kind of where they were at and their economic conditions, which was pretty sad to think about. But eventually, we actually kept poor houses for a couple hundred years. And until the mid-19th century, thanks to deteriorating economic conditions, they knew that they needed a new solution. And it wasn't really until around the Civil War when they came up with that new solution. And in 1862, they came up with the Civil War pension, which was called the Pension for Veterans. They later added to this pension to allow disabled veterans and widows and orphans, and they eventually old age as a criteria. And this was around for a very, very long time and has actually continued even till today's times. And then it wasn't until right around the brink of the 20th century that company pensions came onto the scene. And the first one was around 1882. And what they were doing was they were kind of ahead of their time. They were taking money out of people's paychecks that worked for them in their company, and they were creating a pension fund for them so that way when they did retire that there was funds set aside for them. The very few that were started fell apart, and it was around the crash of 29 that basically all of them were disseminated, but there was very few that started that, but they knew that there was something that needed to be in place. And actually wasn't until FDR wanted to create that basically a self-sustaining program where people pay for their own retirement. It's one of the only programs that we kind of self-pay for. And it isn't just a tax that we get out of the general deficit or general budget. This is money that we've been paying into for a very long time. And so what FDR did was in 1934, they created a committee to compute the program. So they basically were just going through and running the numbers and just saying, how do we do this? What does the tax need to be? how do we put this together and implement this into a plan that's self-sustaining, not only for the immediate future, but years and years down the road where this is going for a very, very long time. It wasn't until after much debate and fights with Congress and the Supreme Court that eventually passed the Social Security Act on August 14th of 1935. So it was a little over a year later when the actual program was rolled out. And to regulate this program, they needed to create an identity card, because back then there wasn't a way to decipher from one person to the other. And this is now known as your Social Security card, which is your Social Security number. And they use that same 9-digit code to track workers' earnings and benefits. So kind of crazy. I didn't really know that. And I thought Social Security numbers were around much, much farther back than that. But it does make complete sense. So even back then, what they did is they announced it. And I think it was like something crazy, like 3 million people had signed up in the first like week or something. Like just a crazy amount of people signed up for this benefit because they knew it was going to be something that they were going to need, especially at that time because they were coming out of the Great Depression. Social Security has evolved over the years. It's under different presidents, under political nominations. They allowed for disabled workers and their dependents, which was around 1960 with Dwight Eisenhower. 1965, they added the ability for Medicare. In 1972, Richard Nixon signed legislation to allow for automatic cost of inflation, because before that, they had to have congressional approval for every single one of the increases in Social Security benefit, which if you think of that today, there's no way that that would allow. I mean, they now have to do an increase in budget each year, which is always like a lock inside of the government. But it's a really good thing that we've put that in place. In 1983, Ronald Reagan signed legislation that gradually increased the retirement age to 67, which is still being implemented today, which is kind of crazy. It's been nearly over 40 years that hasn't even gotten to the point where it is age 67, which most of us, especially younger people, that is our age, but that's still being implemented today, which is pretty crazy. And then little changes have been made kind of along the way to George W. Bush and Obama, but neither really kind of move the needle to keep it solvent. And what I mean by that is there's what's called the OASI, which is the Old Age and Survivors Insurance Trust Fund, which most of us know it as the Social Security Trust Fund. And basically what it is just a surplus of money that they basically set aside and created. So that way, when we hit economic strife or unemployment or anything like that, that Social Security benefits would continue to be paid out. But as we've been going through, we're paying out more in Social Security benefits today than what we as taxpayers are paying in. So they're running basically a deficit each year, and that's pulling from that trust fund that's there. And what they're projecting is, I think, around 2032, if not earlier than that now, is projecting to run out of money. So yes, in the next 10 years, they're projecting that this trust fund runs out of money. And at that point, they're projecting that they could only receive 76% of the current benefits that they're paying out. So imagine what your grandparents are getting paid out. They're projecting out that they're only going to be able to pay out 76% of that. So we know Social Security is going to change. So the question is kind of what is going to change in the near future to be able to create this trust fund that's going to not be depleted and allow Social Security to be around for a whole lot longer and for our generation. So I'll kind of go in through again what Social Security is, and then again what in the future we can kind of project out. So I want to explain how Social Security benefits are calculated, because there's multiple factors and earnings history and the age of retirement that all kind of come into a calculation that projects out what amount you're paying, what your payment is going to be for Social Security. So right now, if you don't know, I mean, most employers know this, or if you're self-employed, you generally know this, but the Social Security tax is 6.2% of your gross wage up to $168,600, and that's for the year 2024. And then this is matched by the employers. So really, you're putting in 12.4% in total for your Social Security tax. And if you're self-employed, you pay that full 12.4% because the employer is not obviously paying in. That's you are the employer. And then another 1.45% help funds Medicare, and then 2.9% in total for the self-employed. So a pretty hefty tax for, in my opinion, for what you actually get in the Social Security benefit, just because the benefit that you're getting isn't being put into the market and seeing multiple double-digit growth years kind of thing. You're basically putting that money into treasuries. And I mean, the treasuries aren't paying a whole lot, as you know. So you're not really seeing a huge growth on that money. But what we know is right now, our tax that it's being paid into Social Security is getting paid out to the current retirees, our grandparents and great-grandparents, and even maybe our parents, depending on your age. So Social Security keeps your top 35 years of employment income. So as you go through and get your earnings history, not only do they look at the 35 years, but even your previous years, that it computes an average while also indexing those prior wages for inflation. So if what you made 35 years ago is going to be drastically less than what you're making today, or it should be, but they're going to index that income that you had from 35 years ago for inflation. So I know a lot of people, especially nowadays, you'll see posts on Facebook or LinkedIn or wherever showing the difference in income versus like housing prices and that kind of thing, and how inflation's gone up crazy for certain things, but not for wage growth. Well, for some of those, it does make a big difference. And sometimes those early years where you made pretty good money might index a little bit better than maybe your top earning years later on in life. But it's really important to have a really good solid wage history, because this is how it is calculated for what's called your AIM, your AIME, the average index monthly earnings. And then once they get this AIME, that's multiplied by a couple of different rates to come up with what's called your PIA, your primary insurance amount, also known as like your Social Security benefits or your full retirement amount. And once you kind of get that, you get basically what they're promising you in an annual salary paid out by Social Security. And this is generally at your full retirement age. So right now it's 67. That could get increased at some point in time for especially the younger generation. But you can take it earlier than that. And this is one of the biggest dilemmas that I run into when we're talking to clients about taking it, is you can take it at age 62 and you can also delay it till age 70. Now, once you figure out your PIA or your full retirement amount, what you can do is you can calculate what your benefit would be if you took it earlier. And what that does is it actually decreases or takes a 6% hit each year. So roughly, if you take it at age 62, you're getting 70% of the benefit that you would if you had waited. Or you can wait an extra 3 years and take it at age 70 and get 118% of your benefit that you have been promised. Now, there's also some other things that get calculated into that, and that gets a little confusing between old Social Security rules and then the new ones. And that really comes into play with spouses and then widows. So spouses can collect up to half of their spouse's Social Security benefit. And this is important for, especially I would say the traditional marriages, especially going way back where the husband worked their whole entire working career and then the mom stayed home, where they didn't really have an income or Social Security benefit, or maybe they had a little bit because they worked for, I don't know, 10 years between high school, college, and then for a couple of years before their kids went to school. They might not have a whole lot of a Social Security benefit, where half of what their spouse is more than what their Social Security benefit is. Now, what people get a little confused is that you have to take your own Social Security benefit. So for that example, I'll just throw out some numbers. Let's say your husband is getting a Social Security benefit of $3,000 and your Social Security benefit is $600. You have to collect your $600, but half of $3,000 is $1,500. So roughly you're taking $900 out of from your spouse's benefit, and then your $600 to equal that $1,500 benefit. And then for widows, what they're able to do is actually collect on their spouse's Social Security benefit if it's more than theirs, and they can collect on that before they actually file for their own. So they get a little bit of a benefit if their spouse was to pass kind of before their regular Social Security age. Obviously, that's not worth it, but that is a little bit of a benefit to them. Now, the big question comes in is, okay, I can take it at 62. I can wait till 70. My full retirement age is 67. I could retire at 65 for most retirement plans, or even 59 and a half. I can collect Medicare at 65. When should I take my Social Security? And this is when it kind of gets into a little bit of a detailed conversation. And this allows us as financial planners to really dive deep into their plan and to say, okay, what are your assets? What are your investment assets? What's your retirement income going to look like in retirement? How much income are you needing in retirement? What's your needs versus what's your wants? A lot of people want to do a lot of things, but what's really your need? If you had to just pay your bills, what's the need? And from there, we can also look at one of my favorite questions, and that's your longevity. So what we can look at is go, okay, are your parents alive? Are your grandparents alive? How long did they live? What's your health look like? Is your health similar to your parents? You know, if your grandparents passed away when they were 75, but they were smokers all their life and you've never smoked, well, maybe you can't say their longevity is equal to yours. So you can kind of look at your family tree and kind of see when's your expected mortality age. And that's a kind of a deep thing to look at, but it's really important when you're looking at the finances. And if we knew exactly when you were going to pass away, this would make this question and this decision very, very easy. But what we can do is kind of run some rough numbers to make sure that we are hitting that break-even point. And what I mean by the break-even point is if you took your benefit earlier, you have to basically pass away earlier for that benefit to make sense, because you could have made more the longer you live by taking it later. So what I mean is, because you're taking 70% of your benefit at age 62 versus 67, or 118% of your benefit at age 70, there's a break-even point on how long you need to live to make sure that you've broke even on your decision. Now, I've kind of just run some rough numbers. This is just a simple example of somebody who is going to earn $38,356 at age 67. Now, this is their full retirement age. So if they took it at age 62, 70% is $26,849. So roughly $12,000 less in income each year because they took it early. So what's the break even between your taking it early and then your full retirement age? Well, if you just did simple math, like in this situation, all I did was put it in Excel and just said, okay, what is my amount equal to? When's my break even? Now, the break even is actually age 78. So you would have to live beyond age 78 to make it make sense that you took it at your full retirement age rather than age 62. And then if you were to do the break even between taking it early versus taking it at age 70, so waiting another 8 years, that break even is age 80. Now, the tricky part of this question is there's also what's called a COLA, and that's going all the way back to Richard Nixon and what he passed in 1972, and that's that cost of living adjustment. So COLA, cost of living adjustment. So basically, as you know, if I usually use the example when it comes to retirement dollars, if you've got $100,000 and you earn 10%, then you earned $10,000. If you have $1,000,000 and you earn 10%, you earned $100,000. So the more money you have and the more of a benefit, once you get that percentage COLA, it's going to affect you more by having more money. So if you adjusted for the COLA, the actual break even is age 76 for taking it early versus your full retirement income. And I think that's really important because most people will live beyond age 76 if they make it to age 65. So if you're looking at taking your retirement income and you're still alive, you have a very, very good chance of breaking even. And then beyond that, that's just when it gets a little bit tougher between the full retirement age versus age 70, and that's around age 80 is that break-even point. As you look at that, again, that question comes into play of not only what are your retirement income needs, because some people do need to retire earlier than age 65 or 67 based on bad health or just kind of the way their workforce terminated their employment. There's a lot of different things that we've run into with clients, but if everything was kind of good in a good scenario or planned scenario, a lot of the times it makes sense to at least wait till your full retirement age. It doesn't always make sense to wait till age 70, but not very often does it really make sense to take it at age 62. Now, there's also some more advanced planning techniques when it comes to taking Social Security. If you were in that traditional marriage where you had one spouse working and one not, well, that could be a benefit where that main income earner waits till age 70 to take it because their full retirement amount is going to be much, much higher. And then if they are a male, usually just based on science, they pass away before the female. So once the female inherits that income from Social Security of their husband, they jump from a much lesser amount, especially if they were only getting half of their retirement income, to the full retirement amount that they would be promised. So for example, I know I use that example of a $3,000 benefit compared to the spouse that was getting half of that at $1,500. If they were promised $3,000 a month at full retirement age, and then they waited until age 70, so they get 118%, which would be about $3,540. If they continue to earn that for, let's say, 10 years, once they pass away, their spouse goes from that $1,500 all the way up to the $3,540. They inherit the higher Social Security benefit. And this goes the same if they didn't wait till age 70. Let's say they just did the full retirement age and they kept the $3,000. They would go from $1,500 to the $3,000. So this is where it's really, really important to make sure that we plan, because if they took it way earlier, so they took it at age 62, they're going to get a significantly less in the benefit than if they had waited. Now, another thing that most people run into, and this is because divorce is pretty prominent in our society, as long as you are married for, I think it's 10 years, then you are entitled to your spouse's or ex-spouse's Social Security benefits. Now, if you get remarried, that's not the case. You have to take your new spouse's retirement amount. So in that situation, that's where kind of the decision to get remarried can be a little bit muddy. We've run into where widows had their first husband or their husband that they were married to for a very long time, made a lot of money. The husband passed away. They received their husband's or ex-husband's full retirement amount, and then they meet Joe Schmo, and Joe Schmo didn't work a whole lot. He's more of the surfer guy. They want to get married, but if she gets married, she has to give up that Social Security benefit. So this is where Social Security can be a really, really powerful tool, and you could also fall by the wayside, because this does provide hundreds of thousands of dollars of income, potentially millions of dollars of income, when it comes to the Social Security benefit that you could receive for your lifetime or your retirement lifetime. So again, retirement income benefits roughly make up a third of your retirement income. So it's a really, really important decision. And for even the lower income, it equals a much, much higher retirement income amount. And so, especially if you haven't saved a great amount, then utilizing Social Security and prolonging your retirement to get a bigger and bigger benefit sometimes can be a much better decision than trying to fund a bunch of money into your retirement at the very, very last couple of years that you're working, because you might not be able to build up enough to build a sustainable income, where Social Security is going to be around for a very, very long time. And that just comes back to what kind of changes need to be implemented to make Social Security solvent and to make sure it keeps on going. There's a couple of different things that could possibly happen. Some little changes that have made over time is they've made Social Security somewhat taxable. So under certain income limits, there could be zero tax on your Social Security benefits. The more you make, the more of your Social Security benefits are taxed. They could change that to where it's 100% of your Social Security could be taxed. So yeah, you receive the money that you pay tax on as a Social Security benefit, and then you pay taxes back to the IRS. Kind of backwards, but that's a possibility. Another one that I have yet to see, which kind of baffles me a little bit, is again, that Social Security tax only goes up to $168,600. So I've found it interesting that for a lot of times, certain parties have talked about taxing the rich. Well, here's a really good example that you could increase that tax to the rich, that really you're only taxing the middle class and under to basically give you that Social Security benefit. Now, what's, I would say, not fair to the rich would be, hey, I'm capped at how much I can get in a Social Security benefit. So if I pay much more in that Social Security benefit, I will never receive that money back. So I understand that from both sides, but from a tax perspective, to keep this thing going, that's a way that you could do that to keep that trust fund alive. Another thing could be pushing back the retirement age. So right now, the full retirement age is age 67. They could possibly bump that back or do some kind of a thing like Ronald Reagan did in place, where just over time, that will progressively get older and older. So for our generation, it could be 69 or 70 before we can get our Social Security benefits. We'll kind of see what happens there. And then I don't think that they will reduce our grandparents' benefits to 76%. That's my personal opinion. This is not backed up by any kind of fact. What I think could possibly happen if nothing changed is the current retirees that are receiving benefits that wouldn't change, those kind of like middle age, maybe age 50 or so, could see that reduced down to the 76%. And then for our younger generation, that's many years away, could possibly see it down to 50% of a reduced benefit. So one thing that we do when we create our financial plans is, depending on age, we will sometimes reduce our Social Security benefits just to be conservative. So I don't want to promise that they're going to get their full retirement amount that they're projected to get out, and then Social Security looks drastically different in 30 years when they're going to take it. So that's just a way we can be conservative when we're doing financial planning assumptions, basically. And again, everybody looks at it different. Every advisor has a different view on Social Security. And even I would say some political affiliations will have different ideas on Social Security. I know a lot of people, once they get really close, they're like, I can take it. Should I take it? Is it going to be around if I wait? I do think that Social Security is going to be around. It's been around for a very, very long time, and it's a benefit that so many Americans need. I think 30% or some crazy high number of current retirees are solely on Social Security benefits as an income. They do not have any other investments to sustain them. So by depleting that, I think we'd be in a really, really bad situation, and I don't think that the government will allow that to happen. I know I've packed a ton of information into this podcast episode, and I've just barely scratched the surface when it comes to Social Security benefits. So you might be going, Connor, I'm 30 some years away from Social Security benefits. Why care now? Couple of reasons. One, you need to pay attention when it comes to that Social Security trust fund and that being depleted in the next couple of years. We need to pay attention to what happens, and we need to make sure too that we're electing officials that are taking Social Security seriously and are really going to tackle this issue that's coming to the forefront very, very quickly. And again, that we want to make sure Social Security is around not only for our lifetimes, but for our kids' lifetimes and beyond too. And then beyond that, I know your parents and whatnot are going to elect their Social Security benefits at some point, and it might be soon, it might be very soon, it might be in a couple of years. I want you to be knowledgeable, so when they start talking about it, you go, hey, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I know that you shouldn't take it at age 62, or you should be very hesitant to do that. Why don't you talk to somebody? It could be me. I would love it to be me. It could be another financial advisor. It could be their financial advisor. Just making sure they're having that conversation, because this is such an important decision when it comes to not only retirement, but your retirement income, and just even the longevity of your retirement income going into retirement. Now, if you have any questions where you're going, Connor, this is pretty high level. I contribute to my 401k. I want to do a little bit more in-depth financial planning. Again, creating a financial plan, it costs nothing to you for us to run that for you. It's completely complimentary. So if that's something you're interested in, please, of course, reach out. You can call or text our office at 269-978-6000, or you can send me an email at cbowserman@hirep.net, or you can just contact me on any of the social medias and we can set up an appointment and sit down and really tackle that financial plan for you. All right, I think that's it. We'll see you guys in the next episode.
Thank you for listening to the Wealthy Homes Podcast. Be sure to click the subscribe button below to be notified when new episodes become available. The information covered and posted represents the views and opinions of the guest and does not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Connor Bowserman or Preferred Financial Group. The content has been made available for informational and educational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional investment advice. Always seek the advice of Connor Bowserman or other qualified financial advisors with any questions you may have regarding this episode. Connor Bowserman is a licensed financial advisor, and any of the investment advisory services offered are through Harbor Investments, member SPIC. Products and services provided are not NCUA insured, have no credit union guarantee, and may lose value. Consumers Professional Credit Union and Marshall Community Credit Union and Harbor Investments are separate and independent companies, and credit unions are not providing security services.